Good morning and welcome to Bank Chat. I'm Hugh Chiverton.
And I'm Brian Curtis. On this morning's program, we ask, what's the state of the MPF now?
Statistics show that more than $146 billion are invested in such funds, meaning an average of over $60,000 per person.
But how many people are actually keeping track of their accounts? Some surveys suggest that not many people are doing so. They only occasionally check their MPF record, and they doubt whether the contributions are being very well invested.
Others are concerned that the funds are inadequate, have excessive administrative charges, or are simply too restrictive.
What about you? Do you know where your money is, or if it's being well looked after? Anyway, you can give us your view. Give us a call, 2338-8266, or email backchat at rthk.org.hk. Very good morning to you. We're joined in our studios by David Webb from website.com. We also hope to be speaking with Stephen Jung from the Department of Economic and Finance at City University. And Nick Crouch joins us on the telephone, the president and CEO, Manulife Provident Fund Investment Company Limited. Good morning to all, and thanks very much for taking the time on this Monday morning to be with us. David Webb, we know your view. You don't like the MPF. You think it should be scrapped and people should have more choice. What about this latest angle? The government and the industry pushing that people simply don't know what's happening with their investments.
Well, that is certainly a problem. If you accept, which I don't, that the MPF should continue, then we need to give employees much more choice in the way that their funds are invested. They should be free to choose their own fund provider and not have their employer choose it for them. And that way, the fund providers would compete more rigorously on the expenses. Secondly, they need to actually disclose the expense ratios of these funds. The MPF Authority in 2004 published a code on disclosure which requires fund fact sheets to include full disclosure of these expense ratios of these funds, how much you're losing every year just from managing the funds rather than from the market behavior or market performance. And so far, I've yet to see a fact sheet to include these figures. I last night downloaded the HSBC fact sheet for 2005 up to December, and I cannot find any expense ratios in that disclosure. But what we do know from analyzing the performance of one of their funds, which is an index tracking fund, is that it's underperformed the index in total returns by about 2% per year. So that basically is how much the expense ratio is. Because index tracking funds normally have incredibly low management costs. If you bought the tracker fund of Hong Kong on the stock exchange, you'd only be losing about 0.08% per year in management costs. Now, that 2% per year can add up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, drawing back to some research that you did, because most people may think that 2% isn't a lot, but if you put it out over 30 or 40 years, it can be a lot. Give us an example of the research you did, how much that takes of their money.
It just takes a few minutes on a spreadsheet to compound the figure, and you'll see that over 40 years at 2% per annum, 55% of your capital and returns will disappear to the management of the fund. And, you know, if you put that into just a bond fund, for example, and you can't expect bonds to do much more than inflation, that means that your spending power will go down by 55% for the money you invest at the beginning of the 40-year period. Now, if you average that out over a lifetime of employment, your money's in the funds for perhaps 20 years, but that still leaves you with about one-third of your money going in expenses. Now, I think that investors and employees deserve to have freedom of choice. They should be able to spend their salaries or invest their salaries how they please. They may wish to spend it, for example, on better education, getting a second degree or some training in some area that would improve their incomes. They may wish to spend their incomes on investing in a home, which will give them more security when they retire.
Then what happens when they're 65 and they haven't got any money?
That's the thing. If for example, they're investing that 10% that they can't currently invest because it's invested for them, if they could invest it in their property, then they're more likely to own their home when they retire. They won't need money to pay rent. And they won't have lost 55% of their savings to management fees.
No, they would have spent it.
That's what I'm saying is not necessarily the case. If you look at the incentives and deterrents, if you do not put aside any of your income during your life and then retire, you'll be relying on CSSA and you'll have a very poor standard of living. We know that that's a basic social safety net. It should be provided. to prevent chaos in society, but it's not a great standard of living. And if you look back over history, people who are retiring now started work in the 1950s and 1960s, and Hong Kong was a much poorer place then, and the real wages have increased so much over that period that people are able to save on their own. They can be trusted. We don't need a nanny state telling us that we must put aside 10% of our gross incomes every month in a state-controlled scheme.
But David, the Legislative Council looked at this for many, many years. I think they had something like 100 meetings or so. Isn't it sort of a slap in their face, the charges that you make, that they didn't get it right?
Well, the policy was made by the government rather than the council, but...
But it was under the scrutiny of the legislative microscope.
I'm not sure that they just have much policy-making power in Hong Kong.
Okay, let's talk to Nick Crouch, because he's a fund manager. He's with the Manulife Provident Fund Investment Company. Nick, can you hear me okay?
Yes, good morning.
Okay, Mr. Crouch, could you explain to us why the expenses, the expense ratios, are so high and why they're not more transparent?
Well, firstly, the expense ratios are required to be disclosed, I think, through this year, and by the end of this year, they will be on the fund fact sheets. The regulations were implemented effective ratios have to be disclosed after 6 months from the end of a scheme anniversary during 2006. So you will be seeing those throughout this year.
Okay, but why do you need something like 2% in administration fees if you're just tracking an index, for instance?
Well, I can't speak to HSBC's product. The actively managed funds will have expense ratios. They will be no more, in fact, they will be less than than what's offered on mutual funds. These MPF funds generally don't have front-end or back-end charges. But in addition to that, providers are managing relatively small amounts of money coming in. Average contributions from members are around about $1,000 a month. There is a lot of regulatory compliance issues to be involved. Providers invested a lot of capital in setting up their businesses, and I would doubt that any of them have recovered the capital that they did invest from the outcome.
So does that mean that these charges will go down in time?
Well, I think that you'll see as the disclosure comes into place and competitors compete for the share of the money, you'll see the free market operating. That's how Hong Kong has operated in the past. There was aggressive competition to get market share initially, and there continues to be competition. But I do think that providers will want to see a return for their investment. The interesting thing is that over the 5 years so far, we've seen a number of steady withdrawal of providers in the marketplace, and yet no new providers have entered the marketplace, which must indicate that the business is not so lucrative.
Okay, David Webb, do you want to respond?
No, it may indicate that the barriers to entry are extremely high. And one of the problems is that it's the employer that chooses the fund provider. The employer has no financial interest in the performance of these funds. They have simply an interest in complying with the law, which requires them to pay money into the fund. But the benefits in the end will go to the employees. The employees have no choice except to change jobs, of course, which is rather a difficult extreme measure to take in order to change funds. It's rather like saying if you don't like the radio channel, buy a new radio. What we should have is employees choosing fund providers, and then there'll be a direct connection between these expense ratios when we eventually get the disclosure and the choice that employees make on where their funds are invested. And secondly, when they change jobs, which happens fairly frequently in any dynamic society, they won't have to change providers. They'll actually be able to take in a portable way their personal provident fund with them. It'll be disconnected from their actual contract of employment.
Mr. Crouch, is that one of the reasons why the administration costs are a little bit high, in that because of this portability?
Well, I think there's so many things which make this quite an expensive type of business to administer. Can I just go back on one point that that Mr. Webb made there? Preserved accounts when an employee leaves are already under their become immediately under it the member's direction, and they can move the money as they wish. Interestingly, now about probably 25% of the assets are now actually held by in preserved accounts under the direction of the member, and the member can choose where they want to invest that money. So,
but is that outside the family of funds that that the company has selected?
It's still within the MPF funds. They have to still stay with MPF approved funds.
Right, but is it outside the funds that the company itself has selected?
They get the choice of any provider. So therefore the competitive marketplace will result there in people competing increasingly for these preserved accounts monies.
Well, Mr. Webb, what do you say to that? I mean, that's one of the main pillars of your objection, is that the employers select the funds instead of the employees.
I think that's going to be a very small effect. And I don't know what the total invested in these preserved funds is at the moment.
But well, you said a quarter, 25%.
You end up with a trail of little bits of money here and there, when in fact what you'd like to have, if you are required by the government to save money, is to have a single fund under your own control. I mean, if you do work for
exactly,
the same employer for 20 years, you don't want to have to wait 20 years before you have that choice and lose 2% per annum in management fees.
No, that's exactly what an employee can do. He can bring together his...
Only if he changes jobs.
His own... After he changes jobs. Whilst he's with one employer, it does stay with the original provider, yes, but it does stay altogether.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at the returns on the funds, and all the returns on the funds are after expenses, you'll note that in actual fact it's the choice of funds which bear far more relevance to the return the individual makes than the percentage of the difference in expense charges that providers make. It's far more important for us to try to encourage members to choose long-term funds. Far too many of them invest at the moment in the short-term money market funds, such as CPF, which have, over the 5 years, have very poor returns. However, the returns on the lifestyle funds have been very, very, very attractive. For example, on a dollar cost averaging basis, lifestyle funds, the balance funds, have returned somewhere in excess of 30% over the contributions paid.
Okay, let's welcome Stephen Jung from City University. Stephen joins us here in our studios at Broadcasting House. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Nice to have you with us. We've been here before. We've talked about the MPF on occasion in the past. I suppose not much has changed, but there is this recent campaign to educate people more about where their money is going. And mm-hmm. we just had a caller, didn't want to come on the line actually, but left a short message saying that she has changed jobs several times in the past couple of years, but she never moved the money from the old MPF account to a new one. And she's curious what will happen. When she goes to a new company, isn't she then supposed to join that employer's family of funds?
I think she must have a choice, you know, either to keep the money in an old fund, I mean, provided by an old employer, or move all the money to the new fund, provided by the new employer.
So she didn't do anything. It just maintains going into
yeah.
the old company.
I think, yes, it's her choice. I mean, she can have the discretion to move the old money to the new account as well. But, I mean, coming back to the discussion, I think it's very important, I mean, for the employers to educate the employees, you know, what these MPF mean for them, because this is their lifelong saving. And also, it's important for employers to provide more choices.
Yeah, but this is the government's mandated savings
yes.
plan. Shouldn't mm-hmm. it be the government that takes up the slack on the educational part?
I think MPFA has some education initiative. I think they should do more, because I see some of the SMEs, the small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly employers, choose funds, you know, for the employees. And sometimes employers may have some kind of a conflict of interest, you know, in choosing these funds. Because on one hand, this fund provider may be the employer's bankers, I mean, providing finance for these employers for their businesses. And on the other hand, you know, provides MPF services to his employees as well. And you see the conflicts of interest, you know, in the two roles.
Do you have any comments on why there are so few of them, why none have entered the market and some have actually left? Is that because the stakes are set too high, the boundaries are too high, or is it because it's just there's no money in it?
Well, I think there's money in it. When you look at the money, there's a huge amount of money in it. But, I mean, coming from the banker's view, you know, if you have quite a number of employees who has quite a small amount of contribution, I mean, here you come the economy of scales, you know. And on a second issue is, we in Hong Kong, we have a few big bankers who dominate the markets. I mean, like it or not, this is the way it is in Hong Kong. We're a free market. I mean, it's not that free after all. So these big bankers, you know, have I'm not want to use the word monopolistic power, but it's quite a big power on the market.
Yeah, I think we've got Geraldine on the line. Geraldine, can you join us for this discussion?
Yes, I can.
Well, what point would you like to make?
Well, the MPF is obviously my peeve hate. I really hate the MPF. And one of the reasons I hate it is, after all these years of putting money into it, working in one company for a long time and then being made redundant, my MPF went from a very large sum of money, after being paid redundancy, went down to exactly what I had actually put in myself over the period of time. Then that went into a reserved fund, obviously, or preserve fund, as they call it, until I found a new employer. After working with that employer for, I think, 7 months, I changed positions. And then they took it and put it into the new company. Then from there, after not... It didn't work out, so I
decided... Wait a second, Geraldine. Are you saying that the 5% that the company contributed did not accrue to you?
No, because it was taken out because they have to pay redundancy. If they pay redundancy, it is taken out of the MPF.
Yes, it's one of the wrinkles that was put in.
Right.
Well, that's a terrible employer's basically offset severance payments.
After 10 years and being told that you don't get your bonuses and you don't get this and don't get that because of the MPF, and because you are what they considered at the time a valued employer, you get a little bit extra in the MPF because you're missing out on bonuses or whatever, you then... are told, oh, well, you got your redundancy money and it's all taken out of the MPF. Well, when I ended up with only exactly what I had put in, not including any interest, I was shocked, absolutely shocked. I was so furious, to be honest, because that is not really explained to you properly when they first came to the office and told us all about the MPF.
But the redundancy money is retirement money, right? Why couldn't you then have just thought of that as the company's contribution and then just put that into the account?
Yes, okay, that's fine. You could say that, fine. But what happens to all the interest I'm supposed to incur as the fund is built up? That interest also went to the company. I think that interest should go to the employee, not the employer.
Right,
and now I'm just finally, after 1 year of going back and forth to the MPF provider over these preserved funds, trying to get it set up into an account where I'm actually the employer myself. I'm self-employed now. It has been horrendous. So over the 2 years, I'm actually losing money on these funds because there's nothing. I have three different preserved funds, which I didn't even know about, quite frankly. They come in and you look at these papers. They don't really mean anything to the most of us. But, you know, you really
Can I ask Geraldine, would you rather have had the opportunity during that period of employment to be given the money in cash and allowed to invest it yourself in whatever product you like?
Thank you very much. Yes, I would have, which I was doing. And really, at the end of the day, the only people, as far as I can see, that are making any money of this are employers, banks, and government. The employee, really, at the end of the day, is going to earn so little amount of money that at 65, quite frankly, they're not going to have sufficient funds to live on anyway. And it's just another ploy for the government to get out of paying retirement funds or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, well, really that question, I guess, should be addressed by the MPFA, who we did invite to take part in this programme. We called them on Thursday, but they said this was too short notice and they couldn't put a speaker up for today. Well, Geraldine, still on the line. I mean, Nick Crouch, yeah. How would you respond? Crouch?
There were a number of points made there. I can't argue that for the knowledgeable and disciplined investor or saver, they would be able to do well outside and provide for their retirement outside of the MPF. But the fact is that there is a huge number of employees who would spend the money and who would not be able to save for their retirement. So the dilemma was for the government as to what would happen to those people when they reached retirement, and particularly in the next 20 or 30 years when there will be two or three times as many people over the age of retirement. The government was concerned that they just wouldn't be able to afford to provide for those people, and the people would not have provided for themselves. You can argue that those people will then realize that they're not as wealthy as they should have been, but often it will be too late by then. So what the MPF is achieving is to ensure that a significant proportion of the employees, when they retire, will be able to receive some financial income. I think most of them, and we've done surveys on this, would admit that their MPF may not be sufficient for them at retirement. And I don't think MPF is
meant to be, the thing that you can stand on when you turn 65.
But the problem is that even though employees recognize it's not going to be sufficient, they still don't want to make those extra savings. So there is a huge proportion of people who would not do what is being suggested.
David Webb, this is inspired by the education program organised by the MPFA, and this survey, which was carried out in December of the year by the Confederation of Trade Unions, 44% of workers haven't checked their mandatory provident fund in the past 3 years. I got to include myself in that, I must say, as well. 30% occasionally read their records, but not in any detail. Only 26% that said they had detailed knowledge of their investments. 78% had no idea if their MPF investments were suitable for them. People really don't care, and they need the government. They need a nanny, unfortunately, to guide them along.
I think, in fact, the reason they've not read their statements is because they have no choice in the way the money is invested. They're restricted to a single fund provider that's only offering them a choice, a mixture of equities and bonds, but no outside managers, mainly.
Geraldine, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Okay. I'm obviously one of these people who are really quite confused about these funds that they come up with and how they're actually distributed and what you're actually benefiting from them.
But Geraldine,
can I finish? They come in and they give you this fast-track talk, which really, at the time, if you try to ask a question, you don't have time to think about what on earth they're talking about. You know, and even when I've gone personally to the provider and tried to sit down with these people, really trying to understand what on earth they're talking about is beyond me, because the majority of the time, all they're trying to do is to promote a particular service. But that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, how does the fund get distributed? How much of this fund am I going to get after the services and costs are being taken out? Why am I being charged for three different funds when it could have all been into one fund? Why is it always going into separate funds? If a person leaves an employment, takes time to find another employment, that preserve fund is then sitting there. If you don't want to join up with the new company, it's in the preserve fund for one ever. But when you leave that one, there's another fund that is opened up. It cannot go into the same preserved fund.
Okay, well, Geraldine, they're good points and good questions. Thank you very much. We're going to have to address them and any others after the news at 9 o'clock. We've got a break for 5 minutes now for the news. Tell us your experiences of the MPF for and against. 233-88-266 is a number. The weather before the news: cloudy and misty with a few rain patches. Maximum 20 degrees today. Misty with a few rain patches tomorrow. 19 the latest readings. Relative humidity up at 91%. Air pollution index forecast for roadside stations today is high.
You're listening to Backchat on Radio 3. Call us on 233-88-266. or email backchat@rthk.org.hk. It's your voice.
Very good morning to you. We're talking about the MPF funds and how the money is invested and whether you know enough about it. We're joined by David Webb from website.com, Stephen Jung from City University, and Nick Crouch, who's from Manulife Provident Fund Investment Company Limited. One of the things we were talking about here in the first half of the program was the portability of funds. And once you leave one company, you then have a kind of fund that is portable. And I just want to put the question to Nick Crouch, because I don't think we clarified this. Once you leave the company, then does your contributions then, can you put them into any of the funds that are included in the entire MPF scheme? Or when you go to the new company, does it then have to go back into that company's family of funds selected?
No, you have a choice of all of the MPF schemes, that MPF funds of all the providers.
For as long as you work then?
No, your continuing contributions with your new employer have to go to your new employer's scheme. But your past accumulation of funds can remain with your old provider, be transferred to your new employer's provider, or go to any other provider as you choose. And you can combine those amounts of money with MPF accumulations that you may have made with other employers. So if you've moved through two or three employers, you can bring them all together into one fund. The only exception to that, I think that the previous caller may have been making, is that I don't believe that preserved account money can be combined with self-employed accounts, and that may be where that lady was having a problem.
That's why she's got several different accounts.
She shouldn't have several different accounts. She should only have to end up with her existing employer's account, a self-employed account, and one preserved account for all the other monies.
She's got three accounts.
Three sets of administration costs. Possibly,
but if you're a self-employed, you're unlikely to be also with another employer.
But didn't she prove Hugh's point by saying that she really didn't understand this whole business of where the money was and what the administrative costs were? Didn't she prove Hugh's point that there are some people out there who need some coaching?
Oh, I can't argue that point.
David Webb could.
I agree that both the SFC and the MPFA need to continue their role in investor education, and more of it should be done at schools as well. But at the end of the day, there are always going to be some people who are more sophisticated in their investment choices than others. I still think they should have that choice, and they'd have to be a pretty bad investor to underperform the MPF after costs, because they'd have to lose 55% of their money over 40 years through bad investment choices.
Steve,
in order to underperform. Now, I wanted to come back on a point that was made about the what happens when you retire, because this whole scheme was supposedly set up, but not to benefit fund managers and banks, but to protect people who are unable to discipline themselves enough to save. What happens when they retire, having been relieved of that responsibility, is that they get a lump sum. Now, if they have been so irresponsible that they wouldn't have saved on their own, what are they going to do when they get a lump sum? Are they going to go and gamble it away at Happy Valley? Are they going to go on a cruise? Whatever, it's unlikely that they're going to eke that money out over the rest of their life. So,
would you restrict their choice more by, let's say, having it go into an annuity and drib it out to them?
That's the point I'm making. If you really believe that that's the reason for the scheme, then it ought to be put into some kind of annuity that pays out the money gradually over time rather than in lump sums.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. David. David, what's your view?
Hello, David.
David, we understood that we had David Humphreys from a retirement scheme.
The Hong Kong Retirement Schemes Association.
Okay, sorry. what's your view, David?
Well, I agree in some ways with what Mr. Webb's saying, but in others I totally disagree. First of all, I wish he would stop using that spurious 55%, because I think Nick Crouch has already said that most of the schemes have made over 30% over the 5 years. I think he's right that 5% and 5% is not enough. I think that one of the key issues that we should be looking at is getting voluntary contributions to be tax exempt, which would help to boost the savings. After all, we are just trying to follow the four pillars of savings as set down by the World Bank.
One, I thought it was three pillars.
It's actually just moved to four. So,
so one's a social security net, one is a personal savings scheme, and another is like a pension scheme like an MPF.
Correct. And the other is for a medical plan for retirement.
So, oh, yeah.
So that's just been thought of, been brought in. And I think I would hope that we're looking at that for the future. I think everybody says what we get at the moment is, I think it's a good start, but clearly 5 and 5 is not enough. We should be looking to increase that and looking for a way of paying out the benefits at the end, as Mr. Webb just said, and rather than one lump sum in some form of annuity.
You say this 50%, the amount of the capital that David Webb says is eaten up by administrative costs, is spurious.
Well, he's just quoting one fund, and
I'm quoting a simple mathematical calculation.
But 2% based on the Hang Seng Bank tracking fund. What you should buy HSBC.
What is the average expense ratio across all MPF funds? Is it any different from 2%? I doubt. The fact is that if you take 2% per annum off your capital and returns. Over 40 years, you'll lose 55%. Over 20 years, you'll lose 33%.
Can I just, though, clarify that? The 55% may be of the original capital, but your original capital would have grown many times during that period. So it is quite misleading.
And each year, 2% gets taken off the total.
Each year, you may have 2% off the capital invested in the fund.
And the returns.
But each year, your returns may well exceed it significantly. As I said, the funds... on the dollar average base over the 5 years. Many of the 50% of the money is invested in balanced funds, and those funds have been have returned in the order of 30, 35, maybe some 40% over that period of time. That's after those expenses have been deducted.
So you're talking about an average of 8% per annum, which would have been 10% if it weren't for the expenses. That means 20% of those returns have gone into costs, haven't they?
Yeah, but if anybody wanted to go into... their own retail funds, they would be paying contribution funds right off the top at the start, maybe 5%.
Well, I'm not arguing that they should necessarily buy mutual funds, which I also believe have very low disclosure levels. What they should be doing is investing in lower cost funds such as index tracking funds, exchange traded funds, which will cost you about 0.1% per annum.
And there are still contribution funds to go into them on a retail basis.
You only have to pay brokerage commissions to buy those.
And the problem is we're talking about 2.3 million employees in Hong Kong. The average salary is between $10,000 and $15,000 a month.
Yes.
And most of them do not have the education or background, the ability to understand those things. Well, I agree that maybe those sorts of funds should be made available.
I don't think that they would underperform the market by as much as the scheme will over long periods of time because of the costs of running the scheme. I agree that it is very inefficient to administer a scheme which has such small contributions on a monthly basis. If an employee was given the choice, they would probably invest larger amounts on a less frequent basis in the market. But I doubt that they'd underperform by such a large amount.
Stephen Chang, David was saying there that there should be more money put into the MPF. Do you agree with that? Will that solve some of the problems?
Well, I think David, his point is we should provide more choices. To the employees, such as
also that the level should be higher.
The level should be higher. Well, I mean, we're talking about a four pillar now. I mean, if we're talking about the medical saving plan or medical insurance, we're talking about several percent of income going into that kind of contribution, the four pillars. So I think MPF right now, the 5% is the right dose. But I do agree with David that even though, the not that sophisticated investor, we should have the choice, to buy the index tracking fund or the exchange traded fund. I mean, that we have to pay less expensive, less cost.
The worst thing about all this is when the providers go around asking you to make voluntary contributions into a fund where you're effectively subsidizing the administration costs of all the other beneficiaries. If you are minded to make voluntary contributions, then for goodness sake, make them directly into the markets, invest the money yourself, then you're free to withdraw it when you want. If you lock it up in an MPF scheme, you won't be able to do that.
Okay, got some more calls.
These are voluntary contributions that you can, and you are able, outside of your employment, to cash those amounts out. And I think that... again, the unsophisticated investor needs a choice of funds that they may invest in. And so that's why an MPF voluntary contribution may be a suitable choice for them.
We've got some emails just like to get through. We've got some callers as well. Mike says MPF is one of the last slaps in the face to the Hong Kong people by the previous British rulers. It continues to fatten British-owned corporation pockets at the expense of Hong Kong people, a bad idea that was pushed through legislation right before 97. Mark says it should be remembered that based on experiences of other countries, the government was reluctant to set up the MPF, but was virtually forced into it by public pressure, fuelled by our illustrious legislators. And Tom finally says the MPF is like a condom. It gives you a sense of security while you're being taken advantage of. And only he didn't say taken advantage of.
You're being very polite. We've got another caller on the line. Is that Gaduri?
Oh, if it's me, it's Jeremy Gadbury.
Okay.
I work in the MPF area, so I've got a kind of interest in what's been discussed today. I think David Webb is right that MPF is an expensive system, and I think we're right to recognise that. But I think also that it will always be an expensive system until we get some competition. And as has been pointed out this morning, one of the problems is that the employer always chooses the fund when you have an active employee account. And we've had some little bit of pressure, questions asked in LegCo the last few weeks as to why this has happened. And it seems as though we could have a situation in a few years' time where the actual employee chooses the product rather than the employer. And I think this would actually encourage costs to come down considerably.
We don't have an employer's representative on, but Nick Crouch, would that be a problem for companies as they sit now?
For the employer as opposed to the provider? I think the employer...
No, for the employee to have a broad range of selection rather than the employer.
The problem would be that a small employer would then have to, if you're still going to have payroll deduction, which is an efficient way of collecting money, the employer would have to deal with a whole range of different providers, and would the employees would have to be provided a lot of disclosure information. There would be a lot of administrative complexity, and I think that the original legislation tried to keep it simple.
Well, I think the problem is it leads to the risk of cross-subsidy. I mean, there were earlier on in the scheme, and I think this has stopped now, there were cases of MPF providers rebating to employers. But if they don't do it directly, then they can do it indirectly with taking effectively lower fees on other financial services products in return for winning the mandate to take the MPF money out of employees' pay packets. And that's one of the barriers to entry. If you don't act as the banker to the group, if you don't have all the payroll services already, all the lending business, all the trade finance and so on, then it's difficult to get into the market.
Okay, we've got Annalisa on the line. Annalisa, what's your point?
Hi, good morning. Basically, what I want to know is we work in a small office and nobody knows how much is in their MPF fund. I mean, does anybody in Hong Kong know this? I mean, how do you find out how much money you have in there? What are your investment choices that you've made? The names in itself are very misleading, whether they're high risk or low risk. And there has to be a way that you can access this through the internet. I mean, how is this done? There's no information provided out there for anybody.
Well, you get a statement, don't you?
Pardon me?
You get a statement.
Yeah, so I'm wondering basically how do I do that, and you know, how do I change my choices if I should, and you know, how do I seek information for this?
Once a year, the provider is required to provide all members a statement of their holdings. Many providers also do have internet websites in which members can look at their complete holdings, their units, their transaction prices, and a whole range of information that they may may wish to see.
Can they also, if they write to you, can they get, say, a midterm update?
You can get midterm updates, or many companies also have IVRS, in which you can get information from the IVRS system. It's just a question of which provider.
Sorry, what's IBRS?
Sorry?
What is IBRS?
Oh, sorry. Interactive voice response. It's the dial-up things where you push numbers in and you get information back over them.
Right, everyone's favorite thing. Okay.
Sorry, I'm using technical.
I mean, nobody really knows about this. It's not, I mean, I just find it very difficult. I mean, everyone says it makes it so very easy, but the fact is, yes, you can go online. Yes, you get once a year, you know, information, but nobody, I mean, this sort of information is, I mean, just, it's ridiculous that they're so difficult to find out when people are investing my money into funds that I don't really know anything about.
Okay, David Webb?
Yeah, I'd like to ask the other members on this call, whether they feel that their employees should be allowed to withdraw from money from the MPF for certain purposes, such as paying their mortgage. Why should they have money invested in funds on the one hand and be paying interest to a bank on the other, when the bank benefits from both ends of that? So shouldn't they be allowed
Shouldn't we take the mandatory out?
Well, yeah, should they be allowed, if it's still mandatory, at least to be allowed, as you are in Singapore, for example, which is probably the ultimate nanny state, you are allowed to withdraw money for home purchase and for certain other things, perhaps
but that's
for education,
33% versus
education or healthcare. Well, the principle is, should you be allowed to withdraw money for reasonable things which will probably improve your overall returns in the end, such as paying down your mortgage and paying less interest?
Stephen Chan, Professor Chan, you want to comment?
Well, in the case of Singapore, you know, the government may have a mandate in supporting the real estate market, so they allowed their citizens, you know, to take part of the provident funds out to buy their house to pay for their mortgage. I think we should be cautious in this area. Going back to the previous caller, I'm sitting on a university the pension fund committee, so I think the employees should push the employers to. Well, first of all, to allow them for more choices, and second, to ask the fund manager or the fund provider to come and give talks to their employees, you know, to educate them what's going on to their funds. And occasionally, in a university, we invite the fund manager to come to the university to give presentation to us on their performance, on their course.
Would that really make any difference?
Well, of course, it won't make much difference, and I heard comments from employees once, you know. He mentioned that if we provide more choices to the employees and to provide more funds to the employees, and that really confused the employees. I mean, we heard these kind of ridiculous comments from the employers. I think education should be provided to both sides, to the employers and also the employees.
All right, we've got David on the line. David, what would you like to say?
On the MPF versus the ORSO schemes. Now, I remember when I was previously employed, I was had a choice whether or not I had to contribute to the MPF or not.
We can't really...
Sorry, David.
Are you on a mobile phone now?
Yes, I am.
Is there any chance you can call us on a landline?
Sure, I can. In about 5 minutes.
Yeah, just call us back in a couple of minutes. Emma has, in the meantime, while we're waiting for that, Emma has called to ask if there's a general hotline that she can use to get access to the information about MPF.
I think the basic answer is no, isn't it? Because it depends on your provider.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there that you can self-inform on. In fact, there's not much information yet on expense ratios, but you can get the performance data from websites of the fund providers. There's plenty of educational material out on sites like the SFC's investor education site as well.
So. I mean, David Webb, you're arguing as if Hong Kong's doing something extraordinary. In fact, by international standards, what we're doing is quite modest. It's not particularly intrusive. It's not particularly a nanny state. Most countries
have
state pension schemes or national insurance in the UK and so on.
If you look at the impact of this on people's disposable incomes, it is great because you don't have 100% disposable income every month. We're talking about the gross figure of 10% overall. That's the amount that the employer and the employee direct into this scheme. But the average employee, if they were given that in cash, it might boost their disposable income by, say, 30%. They'll be going up from $20 of every 100 that they earn that they can spend each month to 30. It would make quite a big difference to the economy. Whether they spent that or whether they invested it, it would be more personal choice with that money. They'd be able to do things like paying down their mortgage, so they don't pay as much interest to banks. It's just silly that they should be putting money into an account.
And yet, most countries in the world do it.
Some countries because have pay-as-you-go schemes, and I think there's a lot to be said for pay-as-you-go schemes. Although people agonize over the demographic bubble, the fact is that you don't get much takeout to the management fees when you're paying through a tax system for current state pensions. The problem with privatizing all of these things is the huge number of huge amount of money that then gets redirected into the costs of administering it. I mean, it's a fact that we've created thousands of jobs for people who do nothing but manage the MPF provisions of everybody else. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a very productive way to run the economy.
But the government says that the elderly dependency ratio will go from 166 in 2005 per 1,000 people, 166 out of 1,000, to 428 per 1,000. If we do what you suggest, and there are people who don't invest wisely, won't we end up paying through higher taxes in looking after these people so we don't have social investment?
Well, there are a number of different aspects to that. First of all, if you have people spending more of their money in the economy, then you generate more taxes to start with, so you can afford to pay more in CSSA. Secondly, the people who retire in 40 years' time will have earned much more in real terms during their lifetimes than people who started work 40 years ago from now. Because the overall real incomes of people have gone up as technology has brought gains, and we've moved away from being a sweatshop manufacturing industry to a high technology and services economy.
That's sort of betting on the future.
Well, also, as people live longer, they are able to work longer. And there's active discussion now in many countries about raising the retirement age because people are physically fitter and able to work for longer. And
okay.
That in itself also saves the costs of retirement.
Okay, just a few minutes left. We've got David back on the line. David, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, thank you. Sorry about that. The question I had for you was whether these contributions to the MPF are, in fact, voluntary or involuntary, because I remember my previous employer did offer a choice whether or not to contribute to the MPF or to choose an ORSO scheme. And if that, in fact, is the case, then do employees have the right to choose between those two, or that
an ORSO scheme?
Yes.
Some employers have existing ORSO schemes that they kept open for new employees and got exemption from the MPFA to allow ORSO contributions instead of MPF. But it's quite rare now to leave that open to new employees.
Sorry, what is an ORSO scheme?
The ORSO scheme is the voluntary pension scheme provided by some employers prior to MPF.
Okay.
I see. Okay, so that only applies if it was available before MPF came into effect.
Primarily, yes.
I see. Okay.
Going back to David Webb, would there be a simple way of perhaps means testing people and introducing some sort of voluntary provision into this?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by introducing voluntary if it's mandatory to save. I think that people should be free to make their own savings choices. There are times in their life when they need to spend every dollar they've got on their own education, for example, or paying back loans that they've taken out to fund that education. There are other times when they are able to set money aside and think about saving for their own retirement or for their children. And if you give people that choice, most people will act responsibly. Some people, for whatever reason, will get to retirement age and not have enough to live on, and that's what the social safety net is for, that society provides the CSSA scheme and schemes like it to provide a basic level of support. But give people the choice, and most people will act responsibly. That's what the free market's all about.
Okay, just some final words, Stephen Jung.
Well, if we give people a choice, you know, knowing that the government is going to be the last resort, and that may create some kind of moral hazard problem as well. You know, people would have the risky life, you know, spend all the penny they have, you know, while they were working. And after the retirement, they have to rely on the government or on the pension, on the government provided pension payment. So it's quite risky as well.
Well, they've seen people pushing barrows around Central with cardboard boxes. They know what that kind of life is like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Nick Crouch, you have some closing comments?
But I would say I think in 10, 20, 30 years' time, Hong Kong will look back on the MPF and see it as being a significant improvement to people's lifestyles as they retire, and employees who in other countries will be looking at the pensions that their governments promised through pay-as-you-go schemes and discover that the governments can't afford it.
Nick Crouch, thank you very much indeed. On the line there, President and CEO, Manulife Provident Fund Investment Company Limited. Thanks to Professor Stephen Chung from the Department of Economics and Finance at CityU, and to David Webb from website, that's W-E-B-B, site.com, and to all those who called and emailed us this morning as we chewed over MPF. Thanks very much. Leaving you now with the weather forecast. Cloudy and misty, a few rain patches, maximum temperature 20 degrees today. The outlook misty with a few rain patches tomorrow.